Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and call the Senate Committee on Judiciary to order. Thank you for being here on this bright, sunny Tuesday morning. We have four bills for public hearing and possible work sessions, and then also a work session standalone. What I'm going to do is I'm going to go ahead and take a couple of things somewhat out of order. I want to start with House Bill 2986A, and let's go ahead and open up the public hearing on that one.
Chair Prozonsky, members of the committee, House Bill 2986A comes to you on behalf of the Oregon Law Commission's Probate Modernization Work Group. It adds a definition of estate to codify existing common law. It also allows the courts to authorize electronic notice of some hearings, updates bonding requirements for special administrators and personal representatives, and clarifies that a request for a different method of calculation is not a request for approval of a specific amount of compensation. There's an indeterminate fiscal impact, no revenue impact, and no amendments.
All right, thank you. Lane, why don't you come on up? While Lane's coming up, is there anyone else who wants to give testimony today on House Bill 2986A? All right, Lane, figure you need to do some billable hours back in the office.
So yeah, Mr. Chair, thank you very much. For the record, Lane Shetterly, here today in my capacity as chair of the Oregon Law Commission, and I do appreciate being asked to go first this morning just to present to you very briefly House Bill 2986, a product of the Oregon Law Commission. This is the third of what will be a four-part march through the probate code to update and modernize it. It has not been done comprehensively for many years. And we have a work group filled with estate practitioners, probate judges, law professor, and representatives of state agencies that deal with estates. A very committed group. We've worked together very well for 3 years. I really don't have anything more to say about the bill than Mr. Lance presented you. It's a kind of an omnibus thing. There's no particularly highly significant change in law. It's mostly a matter of going through, updating, modernizing, and bringing the code into conformance with current practice and where we think we should be taking probate in terms of simplifying the process, clarifying it so that it's easier for practitioners and, frankly, for families and creditors to navigate. Probate is becoming probably less and less common as we get into alternatives to probate, such as living trusts, joint survivorship, ownership, transfer on death provisions, but it still affects many Oregonians, both as in terms of their estates and also as heirs and creditors. So it's important to have a code that's comprehensible and that works through the courts and for practitioners, as I said. So with that, Mr. Chair, I offer you the report of the work group, the Oregon Law Commission, that is part of the legislative history, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
All right, questions for Lane? Not seeing any. We'll go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2986A and open up a work session on House Bill 2986A. Senator Dimbrough.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2986A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Dimbrough moves House Bill 2986A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Senator Lithicum.
There's some dash ones out there.
They're in.
Okay.
Yeah, I think everything's in A is, I think, what I heard was the, where we're at.
Chair Prozonsky, Senator Lentheim, there was a dash one amendment over in the House, but that was engrossed into the A version.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions or comments? Any objections to the motion? Motion carries. Show Senator Thatcher is excused, please. And the chair will carry 2986A to the floor. We'll close the work session.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Hayden, I'm going to ask you if you want to present now. I'm going to come back to another bill and do another one, let you get in and out if you have other obligations.
If you could.
Absolutely. So for the purpose of getting Representative Hayden's testimony, we'll go ahead and open up a public hearing at this time on House Bill 3030A.
Thank you, Chair Prozonsky, members of the committee. House Bill 3030A prohibits businesses that sell retail nitrous oxide canisters from selling them to a person under 21. This offense would be a Class A misdemeanor. These canisters can be used to induce a high and are also used in cooking. There is a dash A2 amendment that would change the age from 21 to under 18, and a dash A3 amendment that would reduce the offense to a Class A violation, and there is minimal fiscal and no revenue impact.
All right, thank you. Representative Hayden.
Good morning. Thank you, Chair Przanski. My name is Cedric Hayden, State Representative from House District 7. The creation of this bill started when the Cottage Grove Youth Authority, or Advisory Council, to the school districts and to the city of Cottage Grove came to me over the summer of 2016 with a concern about a product called, by brand name, Whippets, which are used for the appropriate use to help make whipped cream. I know a lot about nitrous oxide, which is in it as a dentist. That's part of my profession, that we use that routinely. And so they came to me not just as their state legislator, but also as a dentist in the profession dealing with nitrous oxide. Just very quickly, nitrous oxide is not controlled by the drug enforcement agencies. It is controlled by the Drug and Food Administration's for labeling purposes only. So as long as that's labeled as something to make whipped cream, there isn't continuing legislation in the state of Oregon to restrict it. I did look at a lot of other states, and the burden has fallen on the states to look at regulating the recreational use of nitrous oxide through a product called Whippet so that they can get available. Many states have done that, whether it's age or point of sale. Some of the ages are at 18, like you have an amendment before you here. Some of it is point of sale. We did look at all those options, and originally the bill was written at 18. At the request of the Youth Advisory Council, we did amend it on the House side to 21. So that's passed through the health care unanimously, and it passed through the House, I believe, 57-3. And so just want to take this opportunity to say that nitrous oxide is a very, very important medical tool, particularly that we use in surgery and in dentistry, and it is very closely regulated. When it comes to using nitrous oxide with minors, typically we use about 25% nitrous oxide and 75% oxygen. When a Whippet is put into a system that the kids will show you, you can get the nitrous oxide through a process called a cracker that opens up that little vial and it delivers it into a balloon. Once that gets into a balloon, it is 100% nitrous oxide. The body can't live on nitrous oxide, so if a young adult or a child were to breathe that, and currently there's no regulation, so in theory a 9-year-old could go buy these products. If a young adult were to breathe that, they would be getting 100% nitrous oxide, no oxygen, and within a few minutes it can cause brain damage. So I think it's an important thing. One thing I do want to note, that the intent of this bill is not to regulate this. There has been some banter about, you know, we want to stop whipped cream. This, the propellant in this is nitrous oxide. That is not what we're talking about. We're talking about a canister that folks can get directly 100% nitrous oxide that can be harmful to them. So I hope you take this as a serious concern and find a resolution to it. Happy to answer any questions. Yeah,
thank you. Questions for the representative? Cedric, if you can kind of go over the rationale on the 21 versus 18, I'll be very frank. I've told the youth through Richard Myers that was something that we would be considering, knowing that it does have legitimate uses. And I find myself trying to figure, where do we do the demarcation for someone of age versus someone of age?
Correct. And I think that's a legitimate discussion to have. The reason I fell on the side of 21 was looking at other drug classifications, other drugs that create a mind-altering state, meaning if the product is a medical use, it does alleviate anxiety in dental offices, and there is a recovery period for that person to breathe 100% oxygen until they have come back to a normal state of thinking to clear the nitrous oxide. So when you have a substance that alters your thought process, would alter your ability to drive, alter your ability really to walk, particularly if you had been on a high concentration of it. So the thought at 21 is to put it with other drugs that would, or other products like alcohol that create that same type of result.
Okay. Senator Dembrough.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Cedric, if a young person is in, say, a culinary school, and that were something that, you know, part of their training, there were, you know, recipes for using these things, would that be prohibited under this? That is, would the instructor be delivering a canister to them?
So this, thank you for the question. We did touch on that lightly on the House floor. My understanding is no, that it would not be prohibited. I have not gotten an LC opinion on that. The intent is for the point of sale that the person has to be 21 to purchase. It is not the intent of somebody that's working there to be under 21 prohibited from selling it. We get into a lot of discussions. Those discussions are actually ongoing with Tobacco 21. Tobacco 21 has that exemption written into it. So if it is determined that would prohibit that particular situation, I'd be happy to amend it. That is not the intent of this bill.
It might be something to think about, Mr. Chair.
Definitely. Any other questions? Lithicum.
The canisters, this is probably the size of two little canisters, if I remember what they look like. And what volume? I realize the canister's under pressure. If I were to put it into a balloon, what volume would that be? How many breaths, lungfuls, et cetera, and ramifications? Of course, never having experimented in this way, I have no idea what we're really describing and the danger, the potential danger and whatnot. And as I recall, they're not cheap. I don't know, $25, $30, something like that for a pack
of 10?
Never
bought one.
No?
No, I've never bought one. I don't know.
You've never bought?
With it? No.
We'll have some experts coming up here shortly that will give us the value.
So thank you for the question. There is some demonstrations, and if it were permissible, there's also a witness that's prepared to actually show you the process. Would you like a demonstration? I have recommended that maybe we just show the products, but if you want to see the demonstration, they're available to do that for you. I don't know as far as how many liters of oxygen that would be. I'm guessing around 6, but I have not actually cracked one open to know.
Thank you.
All right. Any other questions for the representative? Cedric, thank you very much for coming forward with the bill. So we're going to go ahead. I'm going to recess right now. I've got another bill with one person. I'm going to get them in and out because we're going to take a little bit more time with this one. So we're going to recess 3030A right now. We're going to go ahead and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2251.
Thank you, Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee. House Bill 2251 prohibits persons under the age 18 from being incarcerated at the Department of Corrections. There are no amendments, and there is no fiscal or revenue impact.
All right, so I know Elizabeth Craig is here. Elizabeth, why don't you come on up? And while she's coming up, is there anyone else who will want to give testimony on House Bill 2251? Good morning.
Good morning. Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Elizabeth Craig with the Oregon Department of Corrections. I am here to testify in support of House Bill 2251. This bill aligns statute with current practice. It ensures that any person under the age of 18 cannot be incarcerated in a DOC prison. There's several reasons we wouldn't want someone under the age of 18 incarcerated in one of our adult prisons. First, research tells us that placing youth with adult offenders makes them more likely to commit future crimes and puts their safety and well-being at risk. Second, this practice ensures we are in compliance with the Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention Act, which prohibits sight and sound contact between juveniles and adults. Under sight and sound, youth cannot be housed next to adult cells, shared dining halls, recreation areas, or any other common spaces with adults. So through agreement and longstanding practice with the Oregon Youth Authority, youth under the age of 18 are housed at OYA. They are not housed at DOC. This bill would codify that practice in statute. And for these reasons, we support 2251, and we encourage your support as well. And I'm happy to answer any questions you have.
All right. Thank you. Any questions for Elizabeth? Thank you very much. I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2251. Open a work session on House Bill 2251.
Chair Brzozinski, I move House Bill 2251 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Thatcher moves House Bill 2251 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objections? So ordered. And Senator Manning, I'm going to ask you to carry 2251 to the floor. And we'll close the work session on House Bill 2251. And we're going to come back and go ahead and do our continuation of hearing, public hearing on House Bill 3030A. So we'll come out of recess. And at this point, I have a list of individuals who want to give testimony. I understand that our Youth Advisory Council, the four, want to come up together. So Emma, Ian, Victoria, and McKenna. Why don't y'all go ahead and come on up? So for everyone here, these are members of the Cottage Grove Youth Advisory Council. It's kind of a quasi city government program that the youth have been able to participate in Cottage Grove, and it's a great opportunity to get into civics. So thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And who would like to start? Okay.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is McKenna Roddy. We would like to thank you for listening to our testimony today and thank the Representative Hayden for introducing this bill. We are the Cottage Grove Youth Advisory Council, a committee of students who are committed to making our community a safer and better place to be. We first became aware of this issue of whippets when a mother came into a city council testifying about her son who used whippets, who almost died in a car crash from being under the influence of the inhalant. The youth representative at this meeting reported this concern back to the youth council. We are currently working on a tobacco elimination project and decided to take a look at the dangers of inhalants in our community as well. We soon started to realize that inhalants were a major issue in our community. The many uses of inhalants didn't even know what they were doing is not safe. We brought up this issue last year to Representative Hayden while on the legislative trip, which brought us here today.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Emma Myers, and I'd first like to make it clear that this bill does not prohibit, limit, or restrict the use of whipped cream containers in any way. It is regarding this. This is a little nitric oxide canister. It's really small, and they're very cheap. They're 50 cents to a dollar a piece. You can buy them pretty much anywhere in our community. They're sold at drug stores, at convenience stores, at supermarkets, and since they're so cheap, it's easy for teenagers to get their hands on them. And to be used, you take this little canister and you stick it in this cracker. It's called a cracker. You screw it in. There's already one in here. And when you screw it down, if it's full, it will pop a hole in the can on the foil top. And there's two holes here, and it will blow the gas into the balloon, which they then inhale it from that. And many teens don't see a danger in this. They think it's a gas just like helium. It's not going to do any damage, but that is really, really wrong. It can cause severe damage and possibly even death.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Ian Dukes. So as Emma was talking about, there are many effects of the whippets. Most of these effects are similar to the effects of alcohol, slurred or distorted speech, lack of control over the body, and coordination. It can also cause dizziness and a sense of depression. Just as you're wondering, if you inhale the nitrous oxide directly out of that cracker, it will completely freeze your whole mouth and jaw area as it's contained under a lot of pressure in that can. So they must put it in the balloon first so it doesn't freeze their whole face. And just like any other inhalants, This can cause many problems with the throat, the mouth, because as soon as it gets into your mouth, it's immediately dissolved into the bloodstream. And the process through which that goes, it can cause mouth cancer and throat cancer in those areas. You can easily overdose on these inhalants because they cause a very quick, short high, only lasting about a minute, maybe a little less. So often these are used in quick succession, one after the other. These are easily called gateway drugs, as they can be used to get into many other things. They're often used with LSD, heroin, marijuana, just to cause an even greater high. Just at our local school, we have a bridge near our school, and we found piles of these used whippets under the bridge, and many of the high schoolers there use them as they're cheap and easy to get a hold of. And many think it's just harmless, like helium gas or something like that, that doesn't do anything to your body, but it gets absorbed and it causes immediate damage.
Hello, members. Oh, wait, sorry. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Victoria Roddy. And just to reiterate, they're really cheap. They cost about a dollar, some even less, because they only are 40 cents to make. And the cracker is $9 and reusable. So very easy for kids to get a hold of and use over and over and over again. Because as you see, not all kids have a lot of money. And so this is a nice drug for them to get a hold of and use. We, the Youth Advisory Council, are tasked with the job of ensuring that our youth in our community grow up to have a bright future. Because of this, we made it our mission to ensure that youth are protected and educated from dangerous drugs. With the passage of House Bill 3030, our friends and family and peers will be protected from the inhalant misuse. With help from you, we can prevent not only youth in our community, but in communities all around Oregon from misusing whippets. Bill 3030 will prohibit the use and sale of whippets for the children under age of 21. With first limiting the misuse of whippets, this is a great start, and thank you for listening to us. We hope we have provided you with enough information and understand the dangers of whippets. Do you have any questions?
All right, questions for the panel. I have Senator Manning first and Senator Dimbro next. Senator Lethkin after that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First off, I would like to commend these young students. I had the pleasure of meeting them this past week at the Senator Ron Wyden's town hall in Cottage Grove. And they really impressed me, and they gave me a bracelet that I told them that I would be wearing here. And this thing says something like, everyday tobacco free. So the cause that they have taken up is very admirable, and I got a lot of respect for these students. And I want to just say thank you for coming forward and doing the work that you're doing. It is awesome. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Senator Dimbro.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I want to join my colleague in thanking you for coming here and the work that you've been doing. As you researched this subject, did you find are we alone in experiencing this problem here in Oregon, or is this a national problem? Are other states looking at addressing this?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dimbro, there have been laws in other states that have addressed this issue. It's a nationwide problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then as a follow-up question, as you envision how this would be implemented and enforced, so say in a grocery store, are you thinking that these would have to be behind the counter or, you know, somehow restricted so that, you know, you'd have to go to someone and show your ID in order to buy it?
So kind of what we're thinking is these will be sold in stores that are specifically have baking supplies and stuff for cooking.
Okay. And currently, are they sold just at a regular, you know, Safeway or Fred Meyer or whatever?
They're also sold at places like the Quick Stop Market that just sells, like, cigarettes and snack food. And they're right next to the crackers and the balloons. So it's like, grab my balloon, grab my cracker, grab this, right at the market, and go.
Mm-hmm. So these are meant for a food-based consumption, but these are often sold in tobacco stores with only the purpose of using them as an inhalant.
That's interesting.
Yeah. Senator Lethkin.
It's a fascinating discussion. Thank you for coming forward. And I have a question specifically that I'm wondering about is in my worldview, individual liberty has to be chained to personal responsibility. If you ever separate those two features, then you run the risk of having people who behave irresponsibly. Do you think legislation of this nature, even at 18 years old or 21 years old, that that we are harming an individual's moral capacity because government intervention is coming in and saying, no, you can't do that? You as young individuals, I have no idea what your ages are, but you've taken responsibility and are considering actions, yet the state will be enforcing those actions on every one of your peers, i.e. robbing them of their individual freedom and decision-making capacity. Has your counsel thought through the details of what that looks like and how we potentially harm youth by taking responsibility away from them?
Mr. Chair, Senator Lithcom, we have considered this, but we're thinking that our youth, our fellow peers, don't really understand the dangers of this whippet, and with the enforcement from the government, that they might understand that this might not be something that I should be using. Maybe there is a danger to this substance that I'm abusing.
Thank you.
Any other questions, Senator Thatcher?
I guess I do have one concern here about, and I'm surprised there aren't people here from representing grocery store workers, et cetera. But with the enforcement would be against the person selling it, and the person selling it could be faced with up to a year in jail and over $6,000 in fines. That's where the enforcement comes in. And I don't know, I just picture getting a little summer job at the Kitchen Caboodle and blowing it one day and then having a misdemeanor on my record, and that concerns me. It seems a little maybe harsh.
Yeah. Well, we have two amendments that are before us, which you may not have had a chance to see yet. We're not going to work the bill today. I wanted to get all the testimony in. We're going to have a work session on this because I think there's some other issues that have come up. If you're finished.
I'm finished.
So I want to thank you all very, very much. As most of you know here at the Dais, Cottage Grove is in the district, and I've been very, very impressed over the years. And Richard Meyer, who is the city manager in the second role, has embraced having this type of participation of youth. And I think the Youth Council gives you what you're doing right now, the opportunity to actually see what it is to be doing what we're doing. And we're all hoping that you will take this experience and think about that as you get older, and how you can put back into the community and hopefully be willing to do public service. It's very important, and I think it's really intriguing that you've taken up this topic as one that you want to make certain that your friends and I want to say colleagues actually understand and are informed. So we've talked about the 18 and 21. Why don't y'all talk to us about why you think it should be one or the other at this point?
Mr. Chair, we've been thinking that with 21, just like other substances like alcohol, it gives a little more time for them to think about what they want to do and if that's really what they want to use. And with 18, I'm going to be 18 in just a couple weeks, and I don't feel like I'm going to be an adult yet and that I'm ready to make those decisions. And so having it a little more limited to be able to use would be really handy and nice.
Okay. The other question is, you heard Senator Dimbro ask about someone that's in some type of culinary class that's in between the age of 18 and 21. Any thoughts on about them? Because I mean, a lot of those classes, they have to provide their own tools and stuff, and should they be somehow prohibited at between 18 and 21 from being able to purchase over the counter for their classwork?
Mr. Chair, we've been thinking that a location amendment would be great because that would limit the sales to, like, food stores that they could sell them there. And this bill doesn't prevent people from using it for culinary uses, so they could get the whippets from their teacher and be allowed to use it still and be able to make whipped cream with it for the proper use.
Okay. Senator Lithicum.
Just another thought with regard to following up on the chair's question with regard to sale and whatever. Retail outlets are getting hammered by internet sales. Internet sales, I'm sure, there's a 20-pack of these available through Amazon.com. As cheap as you described, I could get it tomorrow by 10, that kind of thing. This doesn't impact any of those sources, correct?
No, it doesn't.
Thank you.
Senator Denborough?
No, that was fine.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right, any other questions? Thank you all very, very much for coming forward and coming up and spending another day here at the Capitol. So we do have Karen Munsell. Karen, why don't you come on up? And while she's coming up, is there anyone else who will want to give testimony today on House Bill 3030A? Okay. You want to do that?
Sure.
All right. Whitney, why don't you go ahead and share what you wanted to
Yes, thank you, Chair Przanski. Vice Chair Thatcher, I just wanted to follow up a little bit on your, concerns about this being for the point of sale person. It's mentioned in the SMS on OLIS, but there is currently the offense of unlawful possession.
You know what, Karen, please don't do that. I'll come back to that in a second.
Oh, I won't. No, I won't. I'm just putting it together. I won't.
And that will probably touch on this. There is the offense of unlawful possession of inhalants, which is if you possess an inhalant, which includes nitrous oxide, but there's a whole list of them, with the intent to induce intoxication. It is a C violation for the first offense, and subsequent offenses are B misdemeanor. So there is a law governing
Karen,
the use.
I'm
not sure what you're doing, but I don't want you to be doing anything with that canister right now.
I won't.
Okay.
And that was all I had. I just wanted to point that out. Right. Thank you.
So let's put on the record, I do not want to have a demonstration here of how to set it up or how it's done.
Okay.
We're not doing anything for Facebook, and this is not the proper place to be educating people. They can go online for themselves and find it if it's already there.
Okay.
But we'll be glad to take your testimony without the demonstration.
I thank you for addressing this. I'm going to try and answer a whole bunch of the questions that you
Karen,
just
I need you,
asked.
I need you to have your name on the record, too.
Karen Munsell.
Thank you.
Thank you. I've never done this in this building before.
Yeah.
Thank you. My name is Karen Munsell. My husband and I have three children. Our 40-year-old son is married with two children. He's a researcher at the U of O Library, and his wife is a teacher. And our daughter is 30 years old. Her husband is a music teacher, and she's a hairdresser, and they own a recording studio. And our youngest son is 20. He will be 21 next week. So the 21 is really, there's important aspects in your questions. We've never experienced anything like this in our immediate family. We've understood other people, we've had family and friends, but when it hits your child, and you've never even heard of a whippet, I'm going to try and just bring you from there to here as quickly as I can and answer as many questions with what I thought you might be interested in. So I brought a few recommendation letters. I hadn't planned on doing this yet. I was trying to give the Youth Advisory Council the opportunity to take the lead on this because this is with their peers. They're here. They've demonstrated a willingness and an ability, and they have the support of the community from Richard Myers to the chief of police to our retired mayor, Tom Monroe, to our new mayor, and the school district. They have the full support. And I thank you for hearing them, and I'm here today to ask you to continue to support them, now, and I'll give you some reasons why. I'm a retired school bus driver. I have an accounting degree and decided I didn't want to do that anymore at one point, and so I started to drive a school bus, and I did that for 15 years until the diesel fuel kicked up an illness in me called porphyria. I wish Representative Hayden was still here. And the immediate fear for me was when my son, who was top six in the 2014 class of Cottage Grove, took every local scholarship in Cottage Grove, the most in his class, were already through a year's worth of work at LCC. He enrolled at LCC to get his requirements finished so he could apply to the nursing program, so he could get a job after that, and then have a good income to continue on to be a doctor. My son spent his whole life saying, I'm going to be a doctor when I grow up. And as each year I spent 10 years at home sick, I'm riddled with tumors and lymph nodes on top of that illness. I've died three times. I've had more ports and picks and IVs in me than probably everybody in this room combined. Where this came in, when it affected my son, who was barely 18 at the time, that's close to 19, is the chance of him inheriting my DNA from this is a 50-50 between my son and my daughter. And with some of the childhood illnesses my son had, the hospital immediately hooked him up to those IVs and treated him like he had this illness. I bring this to your attention because the importance of it is, if I'm in a hospital and a doctor brings me a yellow tablet, the yellow in that tablet can kill me. IVs have to come from bottles. I am the woman in the plastic bubble, and it's taken me 5 years to be able to get well enough, live, to do this. And so there's these realities. But when it hit my son, I knew that the reality for him of instant death went from 50-50 to 99. And I knew I needed to do something that day. And that day began at 4:30 in the morning on December 11, 2015. My husband and I got a call from Mapleton. Our son had moved to Eugene, so he was going to LCC. We didn't know his every movement, and he was in shock. What we later, a retired fireman ultimately found him and waited with my son until we were able to find him. We live in Cottage Grove. Our son had been at a party in Veneta. Some of the other varsity ball players had created a drug ring there, and that was where my son got introduced to Whippets. And he left that party because a bunch of other drugs started, heroin, they all started coming out. And this is a person still at this point, I'm going to be a doctor, and he is plenty smart enough to do so. So he left the party, and he was angry, and I'm guessing maybe he took some with him, possibly, because he thought he was going back to Eugene to check in, let the dog out, get ready for class. He ended up on the Mapleton Bridge trying to take his life. He went head-on into the substation. When you go over the Mapleton Bridge, right to the right is a substation cement block. He went head-on, and the firemen that found him and the sheriff said he caught a railroad tie next to it by an inch in the parking turn signal of his light, and that caught it in that rotten wood, and it made his car bounce back. He was trapped in the car. The firemen had to get him out. But that, they believe that inch saved his life. I believe there's a lot of inches in the last year that have saved his life. My son is now sober. He is in treatment. He has returned to two of his jobs. He had an offer from every job he had. He was working construction. He hays in the summer. He had the offer from all of those employers. You straighten up what you're doing and you come back to me and I will hire you back. And he has just hit the point in the last month he's had about 3 months sober. A lot of other drugs came in later. I'm sorry. I just want to read some of this right now and I'll get back to that if that's necessary. But I believe my son is where my son is today, because the day we got him in the Florence Hospital, I had them test him for every drug they could possibly test him for. I have that in my bag. Nothing showed. Nothing. Jake later said he told the fireman he tried to commit suicide, and he later told us he tried to commit suicide that night. And that fireman kept him in his truck until my husband and I got to Mableton and spoke with my son, please do not commit suicide and do that to your parents, because my son committed suicide last year. It's my community. I had no idea the next morning when my husband and I were downsizing and moving in with our empty nest to what I was calling my little condo in the city. I still have not been able to hang a picture, but I love my little condo in the city. My husband came out of the shop that next morning with this bag and said, Karen, what are these? And my husband comes from a family where this would be the end of it. And I got them from him knowing that and saved them. And I was driving down Main Street and our local radio was talking about the tobacco ordinance that Cottage Grove has. I believe Richard Myers and our city attorney wrote the ordinance, and that they were going to vote on it that night at city council. So my mentor came driving by, and I jumped out of my car, and I grabbed him, and he encouraged me to go to Tom Monroe, our mayor at the time. I did shortly before city council, and it became an item of the agenda. Tom Monroe has spoken to every mayor at every council across this state. He has asked at the end of those retreats and things, when they're talking about the concerns of their city, what do you know about whippets? And he said, Karen, none of them know anything. I went into the police department, what is a whippet? They thought, well, it's a dog. There is a dog whippet. School district, no, none of us had heard of them. It wasn't until I found them. But my son had come out of our local tobacco shop that they've mentioned with a little brown bag and a box that they come in, a box of 20. And I was at the grocery store next door getting out of my car, and he didn't see me. But he had this little brown bag and it just was so square. And I thought, my son does not smoke. What's in that bag? And it was just a day later that we realized what it was. I, in turn, went to that tobacco store, pulled a picture of my son up, and asked the cashier, do you know this young man? Being it's Cottage Grove, it's small. And she said, yes, ma'am, I do. And I said, please do not sell my son another whippet. If I find any, and I know that you sold them to him, I will bring the police and I will come back. And that, at that time, was the only way I could address it. So in city council, we addressed it. Mrs. Rada, I believe, was the committee person sitting with the council that night. Her father is our fire chief.
Karen, I need you
okay.
to...
Okay.
Thank you.
So I'm asking for an update of the current law. Oregon has current law on inhalants. In 1999, there was an act that was brought up and made into law, and we had a public emergency, is how it reads at the very end of that. This is a public emergency on these inhalants. But in that act is that the assistant director would help create an educational program for students and for parents so they can learn what's going on. 11x7 posters with 1-inch lettering that is in English. If somebody needs another language that is big in their area, they can provide those. But there's also in there legislation that discusses the merchant. And in this educational material and in these posters, the merchant... these are supposed to be made aware of these programs and educated on these programs and offered these signs to hang in their stores. And right now, the wording is they're encouraged. I would ask we could possibly find better wording for that. I am asking that, and I have the support of our city. I just didn't have enough time between Friday night's town hall and tonight, this morning, to get all the letters that I can provide for you as the week goes along. I'm asking the school board, and they have written a letter, and I'm asking you to support our youth. As I said before, they have demonstrated their willingness. I would like to see them. They are getting some national recognition. There's a university in Michigan or Minnesota. Somebody's creating a program, a national program, and they're going to be the guide. And so I'm asking that you would help support them and the assistant director in updating this program, bringing it current. And I know that in our hometown, they would get all the support they need for current posters and trainings and those kind of things. But the merchant is the most important part on my end. Our Youth Advisory Council taking a lead on helping to update this legislation is also important to me, that they, this is their peers that we're talking about. We can't offer bigger fines to drug addicts. That does not work. We don't want our police department to be tied up in catching people. That does not work. So we have to address this with the merchant. I encourage the gentleman to write the letter to you if that's what you received about the cooking school. He came to city council last night. He was going to voice his opinion against this because his sister is in cooking school. She's 18. So if we bring this to 21, she'll have to drop out. No, there are provisions in every state law for medical reasons, schools, and such. And we can assure that everyone will be available that is legally accessing these. I do believe that they do not belong in our corner store markets for 99 cents on the counter like penny candy. This is I brought these today because this is Cottage Grove. This is three separate stores, all within maybe 2 miles of each other, 99 cents. And the green ones that came from the tobacco store, when I went into every local store, and I will be able to provide you with a pledge from nearly every store that they will never sell these. Three stores pulled them the moment I asked. I did buy that cracker, and I did buy a few of the Whippets so I would have them, and it killed me to do it. But stores pulled them immediately. They didn't know what the crackers were. Some good laws to look at are Ohio. Ohio has some fabulous laws, and they track them by the sale. The store tracks everyone that they sell in a card. We have legislation in Cottage Grove where they city officials can go in and track what's going on with tobaccos, make sure they're following the tobacco laws. This fits into that, I believe, in order to keep these available to the consumer like us that is responsible behind the counter at a place like Bi-Mart, like they had to do with the Sudafed. Remember the little novelty lighters? This is one of those things. I would like to see it go further, but everybody does have to make some choices at some point. My initial thought on age 21 is age 21 is alcohol and age 21 is tobacco now. And I feel that age 21 is appropriate. I also like that idea because after speaking with the local clerks in my local corner markets, they felt as well that that would give them more power to be able to ID anyone that looks young. And if we have stores tracking these, my thought also, I'm asking on humanity here, and humanity is what's gotten me this far, is every time a clerk has to reach back and hand them to you, if you keep coming in for 10 a day, they have to make a decision on humanity and not make a judgment. And if they're educated, they can make a judgment. But right now, they're not educated. People say, oh, inhalants, yeah, I know about that. So this is much different than this. And there's an appropriate place for these to be sold. And on the corner stores, counters for 99 cents, in head shops, smoke shops, I bet I could go to our leading people in the Eugene area in the cannabis industry, and I bet they will sign on to this, that they would never sell these in their store. The people that get the education, even briefly, they are on board. And a restaurant owner in town would try to get a letter written saying, as a restaurant owner, these need to be regulated so they're not abused the way they're abused. Our tobacco store pulled 30 boxes the day that I went in there. The owner made her put them back about 2 weeks later and made her sell them. And so now today they're still selling them.
Now, Karen, I need you to wrap up your testimony.
I will put some more of this testimony in writing. It is a lot. And I had just hoped to answer some of the concerns, because I don't want to take anybody's rights. I don't want to do that. I want to help my community. I want to help our youth. I want to help our state. And when I'm done in the state, I intend to take Ron Wyden's offer on support getting to D.C. It's not a big ask, but if we do it correctly, California has some good laws, but Ohio has some fabulous laws. I would encourage you to look at them, but I will put them in my next update.
Okay. Questions? Karen, thank you very much for coming forward and telling your personal story. I know it's not easy, but we appreciate you taking your time.
I wasn't ready. I didn't think my son was ready, but when I was asked, I decided I believe my son is ready, and I hope the next time I'm here, he's with me, thanking you, because I know someday he will be, and he will be our greatest advocate and maybe even a doctor.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. So I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 3030A, and as I stated earlier, we will schedule this for a work session. I want to give members an opportunity to take in everything we just took and heard, and also look at other options that have been raised by questions that have been asked here today. So with that, we're going to go ahead and open up our last of our public hearings scheduled for today, which is on House Bill 2622A.
Thank you, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. House Bill 2622A allows financial institutions to refuse transactions based on a reasonable belief that financial exploitation of a vulnerable person may have or is occurring. There are no amendments, and there is no revenue or fiscal impact.
All right. Thank you. So at this point, I'm going to ask Tim Martinez, Betsy Steinberg, and Ken Sherman, if y'all three would come on up.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Tim Martinez here on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association and the Independent Community Banks of Oregon. Before I begin, you'll notice that the folks joining me today, one is using a crutch and the other is using a cane, but I want you to be assured that neither one of those things occurred because the trial lawyers are not happy with this bill. So just get that on the record. What you have before you today is House Bill 2622A. It comes to you from the House, where it was unanimously passed out of the Judiciary Committee, and I believe received 56-3 on the House floor. As you may know, the Oregon Bankers Association has been deeply involved in elder abuse issues since the passage of legislation back in the mid-90s. In fact, we have developed, with the help of the Attorney General and DHS, what really is a model for the nation on elder abuse training for bankers. And as you'll hear from Betsy Steinberg from Pioneer Trust Bank here in town, who deals with this issue, unfortunately, almost on a weekly, if not daily basis sometimes. We have, the bankers have done a good job in providing this training, again, that has been developed with other state agencies. In fact, this training in Oregon is now a national model. Betsy has been to Washington, D.C. and met with AARP and is in development with them of developing a national model based on that. So I'm not here to tell you that in some states it's not a good idea for bankers to be mandatory reporters. What I am telling you is in Oregon we have a system that works very, very well. Bankers, as you can probably understand, are very concerned about their customers, and we believe this bill simply gives them another tool to help elders and to make sure that they're not or they don't become victims of elder abuse. Mr. Sherman is here as well. He's a longtime counsel. Folks that have been on committee for a while, I'm sure, will remember Ken. He's counsel for the OBA for about 35 years now, maybe. So he has provided you some written testimony. If it's okay with you, Mr. Chair, I'm going to have Betsy do the bulk of the testimony. Ken can certainly talk about his if you like, or you can go to questions and we can answer them at that point. So with that, if it's okay, I will turn it over to Betsy Steinberg. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, fellow committee members, thank you for allowing me to testify in House Bill 2622 today. My name is Betsy Steinberg. I am a vice president with Pioneer Trust Bank, a community bank serving the Salem area. We have one office about six or eight blocks that way, and then my office is about six or eight blocks the other direction, down 12th Street. I've been a branch manager. I've been at the bank for over 35 years. I've been a branch manager for the last 20 years. At both offices, I have dealt with firsthand with financial elder abuse. My most recent case was 2 weeks ago. Financial abuse takes on many forms, and every case I've worked on has been unique. Sometimes it's somebody forging checks on a senior's account, using their debit card without their knowledge, getting scammed by a third party, or someone attempting to gain access through fraudulent power of attorney. Each case is unique, and what I'm looking for are some tools to help us better combat that on the front. I mentioned I had a case 2 weeks ago. In that particular scenario, it was a woman in her 80s living on a meager Social Security income, was her only asset that she had, her income coming in. She had received letters and phone calls from a gentleman who told her she had won the Publisher's House Clearinghouse. He sent her a check for $20,000 with instructions to deposit it at the bank, that she would need this down payment on her grand prize to pay taxes and processing fees for this to claim the rest of her prize. When she came in, it was later in the afternoon, we do training with our staff, and one of the staff recognized that she thought the woman was being scammed and referred her to me, which is our protocol. It was late in the day. There was no way for me to verify the transaction with the other financial institution, whether it was legitimate or not. But asked her to leave it with me. A couple days later, I was able to get a hold of the bank and verified, yes, it was a scam. It was a fraudulent check. And, you know, in cases like this, it's very hard because oftentimes in these scenarios, the perpetrator will say, oh, the bank doesn't know what they're talking about. I'm sorry, it's the wrong account. Let me send you another check. And they'll continue with the contact. So in these scenarios, we monitor the account. We watch for other transactions because oftentimes there'll be a second hit or a third hit. And so that's just one example. I can give you several other examples. As Tim told you, I've dealt with this on an ongoing basis, weekly if not monthly. As he also mentioned, I've been an advocate on dealing with financial elder abuse. I have proactively worked with the Oregon Bankers Association with their training materials. I actually helped on some of the revisions, and I also have taught classes through the OBA operation schools to other bankers on how to detect and prevent elder financial abuse, as well as put together response programs within their own institutions. I also represented bankers on the Governor's Elder Abuse Prevention Work Group, which we met, I think, in this very room with several other in the industry, and we crafted legislation towards preventing all forms of abuse, including financial. I actually served on the subgroup as that as well on Financial Abuse Task Force. As he mentioned, I attended the AARP Policy Institution Roundtable on Elder Abuse with Linda Navarro of the Oregon Bankers Association and Marie Cervantes of OAPI here with the state. And interestingly enough, we were asked because, as Tim mentioned, we are leaders in the country in combating elder abuse. And according to the OAPI report for 2015, 30% of elder abuse cases reported to the state were elder financial exploitation. Bankers, next to family members, are the number one reporters. We're doing a great job in Oregon in terms of detecting and reporting this. And as he also mentioned, AARP is taking some of the materials that the Oregon Bankers Association has put together, and they're developing a national training program, and I am participating on the review and development of those materials as well. Oregon statute already gives us several tools to assist in reporting abuse. House Bill 2622 will further assist us on this front. Sometimes elder abuse is very complex and difficult to detect and investigate. One of the biggest challenges we have as bankers is safeguarding those persons' assets while we're conducting our investigation, or notifying the proper people on that are signers on the account, or filing a report with the state. How do we keep their money safe while all this is going on? House Bill 22 would allow us to refuse transactions, disbursement of funds, change of ownership, or instructions given by an agent under the power of attorney while this investigation is taking place. It will also provide notice. We would have to provide notice to all parties authorized to transact business on the account unless we determine that providing notice will compromise an investigation or response in the suspected financial exploitation. And again, there's a cap on this time frame. It's 15 days. I think there are some, if I'm not mistaken, provisions to expand that under certain circumstances. But 15 days is more than adequate usually to put everything in motion in terms of either filing a report or getting the family involved, whatever is appropriate for the situation. I would like to underscore this bill would not prevent financial institutions from allowing legitimate transactions to come through the account for the care and upkeep of the vulnerable person. That's a very important key element to have in place, is to not deny legitimate transactions. Statistics show elder financial exploitation is increasing every year. We are the front line of this abuse, and this would be a very important tool for helping us to combat it. And thank you for your time and consideration, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you have or turn it over to Ken.
All right, we'll take Ken's testimony first.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm going to be very brief. I think Betsy's done an excellent job of outlining the bill and framing the problem that it seeks to address. I had a hand in drafting this legislation, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
All right, thank you. Questions for anyone on the panel? Senator Thatcher first.
Thank you. You mentioned the training, and I think it's been mentioned in previous bills, the substantial training that is given to people in the financial institution, financial sector. I'm wondering if any of that training involves reporting to any state agencies.
Actually, a good section of that goes into the reporting. When I go out and train, I also not only tell them about the reporting, but explain to them, you know, what happens during the report, what they're looking for, kind of take them through the whole course of it. The materials also outline that. In fact, another side note, I've met and worked with the state of Oregon and working with the investigators to help them understand financial exploitation. So this is there's a real partnership going on between bankers and the people that are actually investigating on the state side. So,
Betsy, if I can just follow up on that, your protocol for your lending or your bank, Why don't you walk us through if someone, meaning a teller, believes that something's going down that shouldn't be happening?
Sure.
Protocol from is what?
Okay. There are different ways that that may come to a teller or a bank staff, depending. The transaction may be present in the window. The people may actually be in the lobby of the institution, or they may be reviewing transactions, maybe looking at a deposit and notice something's awry. And so the tellers, are first duty is to refer them to their supervisor. And so in my office, it's usually me because I'm the branch manager. Depending on the circumstances, they'll give me a quick overview, bring whatever documents they have, and I'll make a quick assessment. I might pull the individual, the older person, into my office and talk with them about the transaction so that I get a better idea. And then again, there's so many variables. At that point, it's up to my discretion to decide whether I need to file a report, whether I need to freeze the transaction, whether I need, you know, what steps I need to take. In some circumstances, if the person is confused, there may be a signer on the account. I may attempt to get a hold of whoever is responsible or signer on the account. In one case, I know a couple of cases I've had to call the police because the one of the questions I will ask is, do you feel safe? Have they threatened you? And so, again, every case is different. You know, there are different roads that can take us down. And I know in one we had competing members alleging that the other people were committing financial abuse. And so, literally, not only did I have to file a report with the state, but we had to freeze the assets while they somebody had to get a conservatorship in place. And so that took quite a bit of time. And that's one of those scenarios. Again, I had two different parties in the same family trying to get control of the parents' money, and each alleging that the other was abusing the mother and the mother was not competent.
Okay. Other questions? Senator Thatcher.
So nobody else is going to come up here. All right. So this training that you have, you have a lot of protocols in place. And yet there are state laws that want to make it mandatory for some people to report. Why is that not something you would want to participate in?
Banks have several things that they have to do mandatory reporting on, both the federal level and on the state level. And, well, first of all, and first and foremost, I would say the statistics show that it's really not necessary in Oregon because, again, we are the highest, we're the number one reporters. We beat out all the mandatory reporters already. But banks tend to be defensive reporters, and what I discovered when I was on the committee with for the Elder Abuse Financial Work Group is that I'm not alone in this assessment. I think we would inundate the system with unnecessary reporting. It isn't always, you know, if I have somebody, a family member that's already on file, why would I have to make a mandatory report? It might just be a matter of them either getting whatever legal documents they have to have in place or getting them involved to secure the finances themselves. You know, again, it's not always appropriate, but foremost, I think banks would just automatically report every little tiny little thing, and we would just overwhelm the system so that the real cases that need to be investigated, there's not time for the ones that really merit the reporting.
And Mr. Chairman, if I could just add briefly to Betsy's comments, I agree with everything, Mr. Chairman, Senator Thatcher, I agree with everything Betsy said. And I guess I would just add that if this was, we've worked very closely with DHS over the years, we've worked closely with the AG, and in fact, the AG introduces our training program and how important it is and the problems with elder abuse. I guess I would just add that if either one of those folks or those agencies or their attorney general saw this as something that ought to happen, and I don't think they've come in since I've come up here, but they would be at this dais or at this table telling you to consider that. So I would just add that. Thank you.
All right. Other questions? So I guess I'm going to pose one other question kind of following up with Senator Thatcher regarding immunity, liability, et cetera. Do we have any records? I mean, in the sense of I can see where you don't want to be required as a mandatory reporter for the reasons you put on the record, Betsy, that anything and everything could end up getting over-reported. At the same time, I'm wondering, with it being discretionary and also having immunity, if someone chose not to report when, I mean, on its face, they should have reported. I mean, it's a protocol wasn't followed or whatever it was, for whatever reason, oh, I know that person, or it's okay. And then it turns out to be something that's detrimental to that client of yours. What's the accountability there if we don't have either mandatory required reporting, or you have the ability to claim immunity because you chose in that case not to do it, even though obviously it should have been done?
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to let Ken answer that.
I was going to say,
first, that's all right.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ken Sherman, General Counsel.
He would be earning his keep today.
I think the response to that basically is that the relationship between the bank and its customer is a contractual relationship, which, among other things, imposes certain duties and responsibilities on both parties. And one of the responsibilities of the bank is to not be negligent in its handling of its customers' funds. And so there's always and always has been that potential liability on the part of the financial institution that is egregious and ignoring an obvious sign of something like this. And I think I haven't really researched it, but I believe there are cases around the country where financial institutions have been held responsible, whether there's any reporting law or not, just because of the responsibilities under the basic contract that exists between the financial institution and the customer. Does that respond to your question?
It does, but it doesn't.
Okay.
It does in the sense that I agree with that concept and how that would play out. But let's just, I guess, a scenario. You have a customer long-term with the bank, and then it seems like something is going on in the sense that they're being taken advantage of. For whatever reason, if the bank chose not to report that or take any action on that, my reading of how this bill is written at this point, there's immunity that would be attaching. Now, maybe it's only when you file the report as the immunity attaches as compared to not acting that the immunity would not be in place. If that's the case, we can clarify that for the record.
Mr. Chairman, I believe that's exactly the case. The concern that we had and the reason for including the immunity provision was to make it clear to everyone that if a bank does believe that there's something going on and makes a report or takes action to put a hold on the account or whatever they do, that they're not going to be held liable for having done that.
But they'd still be potentially liable,
yes.
Let's say, if the the kids who are, you know, their senior parents are being taken advantage of could still come against the bank if there was negligence.
That's correct.
If you did not have a safe harbor, you would, it would be detrimental. Banks would not utilize this as a tool because of fear of being sued. Everything is about risk.
Oh, yeah.
You know, in our approach to dealing with our customers. And you've also got some federal statutes that kind of leave you feeling a little uneasy when you deny somebody access to their funds. And so, again, I think having a safe harbor for a local statute, particularly in this, and this was a concept that was actually discussed at the AARP seminar back in Washington, D.C., because there were like three or four other bankers that were there, and we all do the same thing. And the conversation was, you know, we do it, but we don't feel like we have a leg to stand on, you know, in terms of a safe harbor, and that is something that is a really key component.
Yep.
Okay. To allow us to proceed on
any
that.
Any other questions? All right, thank you all very much for coming forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
What I'm going to do is just recess just for a moment because I neglect it when I now look at the work session. I look who's still here. The Department of Corrections actually are waiting for us to actually take care of the work session issue there. So I'm going to recess this real quick, open up a work session on House Bill 2249.
Thank you, Chair Prezonsky, members of the committee. We previously heard House Bill 2249 on April 27th. It allows the Department of Corrections to provide counties with supplemental funding for reentry support for offenders released before turning 25. At that hearing, there was some discussion about whether there was the need for the emergency clause, and you now have the Dash 1 amendment, which removes the emergency clause. The Dash 1 amendment has no revenue and no fiscal impact.
All right. And
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2249 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Thatcher moves House Bill 2249.
Oh, do we need the dash one? I'm sorry.
If you,
Mr. Chair, I rescind that particular motion and replace it with moving the dash one amendment to House Bill 2249.
All right. Senator Thatcher moves the dash one amendment to House Bill 2249. Discussion? Any objections? So ordered.
All right, Mr. Chair, I'm ready to move House Bill 2249 as amended with the dash ones to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Thatcher moves House Bill 2249 as amended with the dash ones to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objections? So ordered. Senator Dimbrough, will you be the carrier on this one, please?
Sure.
We'll close the work session on 2249. We'll come back out of recess on to House Bill 2622A. And Arthur Towers. Art, why don't you come on up? While he's coming up, is there anyone else who wants to give testimony today on 2622A? And I apologize, ladies.
Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Arthur Towers, here on behalf of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. Our members fight for consumers who've been defrauded or injured. And we're particularly concerned with the rise in elder abuse, both financial and physical. Anecdotally, our members are reporting an increased number of problems in this area, and we heard earlier that statistics bear that out. The role we play is coming in after the fact, after people have been defrauded. And so we're very concerned with, well, first of all, we feel like there's a number of positive points in 2622, and we don't want to minimize those. But we do want to draw a bright circle around the issue of the immunity. The idea that the elderly who, if they are defrauded, would be denied the right to bring forward a case against the bank if they truly believe that they can prove that the bank was involved in the fraud. That is a consequence of the legislation. The sorts of things that the banks would be allowed to do, refuse reading from page 2 of the bill, refuse a transaction with or involving the vulnerable person, refusing to permit the withdrawal or disbursement of funds contained in a vulnerable person's account, preventing a change of ownership of a vulnerable person's account, preventing a transfer of funds, refusing to comply with instructions given to the financial institution by an agent or attorney in fact under a power of attorney. I mean, there's a variety of powers given to the banks in this provision, and that is all well and good if they are held responsible if things go wrong. We feel that there should be a trade-off here, either become mandatory reporters, or if the system's working as smoothly and as well as being reported, I don't doubt that it is, then don't provide the immunity. We need to protect the rights of the elderly, and this bill in many ways goes in that direction. We feel that that this immunity piece does, again, block the elderly from having their day in court. We urge the committee to follow the approach of the state of Washington, grant the immunity but require the reporting. But we also feel better about the bill if the best policy is to not require mandatory reporting, then take the immunity out of the bill. There's a little bit of talk earlier on about federal statutes not providing the safe harbor. There's probably a good reason for that. Talked about protecting contracts or having the contractual rights be a place that people can recover as well. In other words, if the contract is broken, then the elderly can be protected. I would be concerned that many of those contracts have binding arbitration that would make it difficult for consumers to, again, get their day in court. And I'll just conclude by saying that, you know, there's been a lot of good reports and a lot of positive reports. And, you know, if you're based on what I heard today, if I had a loved one who needed financial help, Pioneer Bank sounds like a great place to go. But, you know, Wells Fargo sounded like a great place to go before they started defrauding their consumers. You know, our job is to look at the, you know, we end up dealing with the worst case scenarios, and we want to prevent against those. And we think that that fix to 2622, either mandatory reporting and immunity or voluntary reporting to give the sole discretion to the banks for making these decisions, should not be granted immunity. Senate Bill 95 with Stockbrokers, I believe, was a bill that came through this committee, and you required broker-dealers to report. And so we don't think it's completely unreasonable to ask financial institutions to do the same. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Dimbrough.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. So just to clarify, you don't have a problem with the banks having immunity if they take action because they suspect something is wrong, and they take what they felt was appropriate action to stop a transaction. You don't have a problem with that kind of immunity, right?
Right. I mean, if they're reporting that they suspect financial abuse, and you know, it can be a phone call. I mean, if they suspect that, then and report it, then we're fine with the immunity. We think that that's the trade-off right there.
Your concern would be that they would have immunity for not taking action when a reasonable person, given the information they had, should have taken action. Is that correct?
Chair Przanski, Senator Dimbrough, I'll try to follow that question. But our sense of things is that if the bank follows the protocols and does what they're supposed to do, and that the chances of them getting successfully sued are minimal, right? I mean, they've done what they're supposed to do. They suspected something was wrong. That's not. But what happens when they don't go through the training? What happens when they don't follow the protocol? Under the situation that we're describing here, they would be immune from decisions they made one way or the other, based on that list of activities that are listed in the bill. Is that helpful?
Yeah. So, Arthur, based on the testimony we took right before with Ken, I got the impression that that would not be the case, that the bank would still be on the hook if they neglect it, and it could be shown and demonstrated that they failed to report when a reasonable banker or someone in their shoes would have done so, as compared to, because what I heard, and Ken, why don't you come on back up here? I just think we need to flesh this out a little bit more. My understanding is that this immunity is only when the bank or financial institution has actually pursued notification and taken steps on the account, as compared to not taking any of those steps that are available. Ken?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. The immunity applies only if a financial institution takes one of the actions that's described in subsections 1-5 of this section. If they fail to act, then they may have liability for negligence or wrongful, intentional misconduct, just as they do today. So we're not changing that at all. What we want to do is create a situation where the financial institution that sticks its neck out and says, I think there's something fishy going on here, is going to be protected from that. And I think Arthur is agreeing with that. That's a good thing.
Yeah. So let me just put the other thing on the record, that based on what we heard, if you had a bank that was involved in the actual act, my perspective would be that, just as we just heard, that would be direct actionable against the bank. There'd be no immunity. I'm trying to figure out how this could work. If someone at the bank called in that someone at the bank was doing something wrong, I don't necessarily see the bank getting immunity because one person at the bank called it in, noticed when it was actually a coworker doing it. So, I mean, if we need to flesh that out, I mean, clearly that's not the intent, that a bank would be able to somehow protect itself where the bad act is actually occurring at the institution.
I absolutely agree, Mr. Chairman, and I think that is clear from the language of the section. The immunity applies only if the bank acts or the banker acts affirmatively to take one of those actions to put a hold on the account.
All right, before we take another question, Arthur, based on what you've heard Ken say, do you think you're still in the position of thinking that that's not correct?
Chair Przanski, I'm not positive, but if you look at that list of activities again, A through E, there on page, at the top of page 2, are there actions there that they take? You know, let's say the a bank decides they're going to have a mandatory waiting period on, you know, transactions involving vulnerable persons' accounts, and that creates some sort of hardship or liability for the account holder.
Well, I guess my reading of that, Arthur, I got that, but it's somewhere in here it also says that I thought there was a duty that if the bank determines that it's a legitimate transaction before the 15 days runs, that they're supposed to basically move forward and not hold it for the full 15 days. And if that's not clear enough, we can make that clear, because it's reasonable to say we got an end date, that's 15 days. But if you find out 2 days after you put the hold on it, everything's right, that you should not be holding that transaction for 13 more days.
Yeah, if like that, it would be helpful to, it would, Chair Prusinski, it would definitely be helpful to get that fleshed out.
All right. So I'm going to go ahead and Senator Manning has a question, and I don't know if anyone else does, but I'm going to follow back up as to how we're going to move forward. But go ahead.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I guess this would be directed at you. I think Mr. Tallis had mentioned the bill, the hearing that we had regarding other financial institutions and stuff. And I don't know if we also included in there that there was some type of immunity for them, or did we? Because I can see this coming back to us to say, well, you did it for the bank, and we are a financial institution. That's the key word, financial institution. And if you do for one, then it should apply to all.
Yeah. And Senator Manning, I think it actually covers those, because if you look at Ken's first paragraph, it says the association introduced the bill to give banks, credit unions, and trust companies another tool for combating. So to me, that seems like it's pretty inclusive of financial institutions. I believe the bill that you're talking about, if I remember, was Senate Bill 95.
Yes. And my computer is down, so I can't pull it up.
Yeah. And so we're not going to work the bill today.
Right. Okay.
I'm going to take just a few moments, you know, and since we'll get it scheduled, I plan to work the bill. But what I want to do is look at the language, see if there's anything else we feel that we need to supplement. Clearly, one of the things we can do, and I will want to do, is put on the record, on the floor, exactly some of these points, so we can, in fact, have a record there if we feel like we don't need to wordsmith the bill itself, but we just need to enhance what is there in an oral statement. We'll do it that way. Senator Lipkin?
Per your note about financial institution, it refers to ORS 706.008 for defining all of those in
okay.
the bank. And then with regard to expedition and not waiting the full 15 days, Section 2, Sub 4 says, Subsection 1 of this section will expire upon the sooner of, and then there's A, B, C, D, and E. And I guess my, for clarity's sake, that's only subsection 1 will expire versus other items, which then you have to go back up and see subsection 1 under section 2. I'm not sure that timing's is clear.
Okay. So yeah, we'll look at that. I believe the way it's just basically saying if they take action in a sub 1 section 2, if they find out relatively quickly that everything is germane and it's legit, then they have that duty to pull. And so I think it's there.
Okay.
What we're doing now is helping set the record as to what our understanding is, what our expectations are. All right. So, Arthur?
So, Chair Prusinski, Senator Linthicum, is it your understanding that if they violated that subsection 4 and held the money for the full 15 days, that with the immunity they would be not held responsible?
No. That is absolutely not what my intent. My impression of what this is and what we have on the record is that they have an active duty that once they have determined that the transaction has legitimacy and there is no other hindrances, that they then have an active duty in a very reasonable period of time to release that transaction. Ken?
Mr. Chair, I would concur with that, and I would also point out that if the bank had determined that there had been nothing amiss and nevertheless kept the hold in place, they'd be in violation of the federal funds availability law.
Okay. All right. So other comments? Yeah, let's go ahead and get the comments on.
Sure. I'll just follow up with that, Chair Brzezinski. I just wanted to point out in that subsection 6 that deals with the immunity, it specifies that the immunity applies to subsections 1 and 5, and that 15-day period is in subsection 4. So when I read that, I don't think the immunity applies if there's a violation of subsection 4. It doesn't say 1 through 5. It's just 1 and 5.
Right. We'll look at that. We may want to tighten that down.
That's fine.
That sound right, Ken?
Thank you.
Great. Because we, Chair Brzezinski, we do want to get to the place where we can support the bill because there's other fine pieces in it.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll take it through one more look and make whatever adjustments. I assume we'll have this up for work session first of next week, just because, and I say that because we need to, my understanding is we're not meeting tomorrow based on our schedule issues that happen. We are, just to let everyone know, planning on meeting on Thursday. We had planned on doing a correctional tour, and it turned out that the jail was not able to accommodate us after we thought they could. So I know that Josh is trying to put together some bills, so I think we'll be here on Thursday, but I don't think we'll have this resolved for Thursday. That's why I'm saying sometime next week we'll get it scheduled. We are now? All right, so we are posted just for everyone in the committee for Thursday at 8:30. All right, gentlemen, did y'all have any other comments, closing comments?
No, I don't believe so. Thank you very much.
Thank you all very much for coming forward, and thank you for not duking it out. And if he gets out of hand, you've got the cane. All right. Any other comments or concerns? So,
Mr. Chair, you had mentioned tomorrow, Wednesday. We are having judiciary tomorrow.
Tomorrow you get to sleep in.
Oh, man, what's happening? That's well, not good for me.
The issue here is very simple. The bills flows, the stuff coming over from the House have been, unfortunately, a little bit slower. I did see yesterday's first readings. We had a number of bills that are coming out of judiciary, so we're kind of catching a lot of the tail end. It's just that we have 48 hours still posting notice. That couldn't happen. On yesterday morning, we looked at whether we could do it, but by the time we were trying to make a decision, it was already after 8 in the morning, and so we decided not to try to do that, but we are recovering for Thursday. Okay. So hope everyone enjoys tomorrow as to not needing to be in committee, and we'll see everyone back here on Thursday at 8:30. And Lisa, is there anything else I need to cross over? Okay, we're adjourned. All right. So, okay, we're adjourned. All right.